Hello, I am Emma, the 11th Duchess of Rutland, and this is Duchess, a podcast in which I explore the most historic homes of the UK and meet the inspiring women who lead them. As a daughter of a Welsh farmer, I grew up far away from the glamour and wealth of aristocracy, but my life changed forever when I fell in love and married my husband, the 11th Duke of Rutland. Suddenly, one of Britain's most historic buildings was not only my home, but under my care. I wanted to hear the stories of other women like me, the custodians of these great homes. So in this podcast, I will travel to breathtaking homes and meet the inspiring women who lead these estates today. Please join me on this special journey. This is Duchess, the podcast. Deep in the picture book beauty of North Yorkshire rests one of Britain's most enduring sites, Ripley Castle. Ripley typifies the image one may have when thinking of a medieval castle. A robust grey slated exterior, crenellated roof, watchtowers, secret rooms, spiralling staircases, and precious treasures. Just as the castle's beauty endures, so do the occupants. The Ingleby's have remained at Ripley for a staggering 700 years, and it is Lady Emma Ingleby, who I had the pleasure to call one of my friends, that I will be speaking with today. Emma is the epitome of humility, commitment, and determination. She has been one of the brightest guiding lights on my journey in heritage, and I'm so pleased to have her on the show. Emma and I spoke about the Ripley's rebellious past, mischievous ghost, and why stately homes must be family homes. Thank you, Emma, for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Just set the scene of exactly where we are. We are 3 miles from Harrogate.
Yeah, between Harrogate and Ripon.
They call you Lady of the North, is that right?
It is, because I'm a York girl by birth. My grandparents were Quaker merchants, and I was born within the sound of York Minster bells. I think Lady of the North is a polite way of saying a northern girl.
So tell me, how would I address you as a member of your staff here at Ripley?
To my face, they call me Lady Ingleby or the boss.
And to me,
Em or Emma.
I can call you Emma.
Yes.
Lovely. Thank you so much. So we are here today in this wonderful drawing room. Describe this drawing room to our listeners.
It's just a lovely yellow room. It looks out, as you can see, onto the lakes. In these large houses, you really only decorate once in your tenure. And so this room was done when we first moved in. And so it's kind of quite chintzy, but I've never got bored of it. It's got corally curtains with lovely flashes of blue. And then the walls are yellow because I just think yellow is terribly relaxing.
And looking out over those lakes, yeah. What a great way to spend an evening.
Well, the thing to understand is that the castle is open usually 360 days a year, and we wanted some privacy, so we converted some of the bedrooms.
But this room doesn't feel as if it's 14th century.
No, you're in the Georgian part of the house. So if you approach the castle from one direction through the gatehouse, it looks very castly. If you look at it back down the lakes, you see the curved rooms and it looks much more elegant and Georgian.
So you've got a lovely cross-section of both.
Yes, we've got a cross-section of
both. It's very nice to live in Georgian, I guess.
It is. It's airy and light.
And can I ask you what age you were when you met Sir Thomas?
I met Thomas. I didn't know he was Sir Thomas. I met him when I was 18.
Goodness.
I didn't know him. He was just introduced as Tom Ingleby. First time he brought me here to stay, he brought me here in the dark. And I remember thinking, gosh, those are big gates. And he showed me to a bedroom and I woke up in the morning, opened my shutters, and there was a castle. And I was like, I went home to my mother that night because we spent the day together, and then he dropped me home. And I said, I think he lives in a castle. And she said, well, where did you go? I said, I don't know, somewhere near Harrogate. It was dark because I came from the other side of the county, so I had no idea.
How lovely. That is magical.
We didn't marry till, it was interesting, we went out for a year, and then I was about to do a business studies degree down in Bristol. And so he dumped me.
Goodness.
The cad.
Great move.
He dumped me, let me do my degree and pick me back up again in the last year.
Very bright move, Sir
Thomas. Stupid. I always say that. If you can't, we jokingly say it, but you look back and you think in the old days, you know, there was the thing of marrying an heiress. Now, if you can't marry a girl with money, you marry a girl who can earn you money.
He definitely got that right here at Ripley, because Emma is one of the most driven, focused individuals that I know in this world.
But we married when I was engaged when I was 23, married when I was 24.
How did you find that when you first arrived here, Em?
I think it's about being young and having no fear. We kind of decided we wanted to become more commercial. The conference centre in Harrogate had just been built, and we thought, well, we'll do dinners and open the place up and we'll do shops.
Just let's go back a step, because what was it like then? What was the building like?
It had been post-war. I think it's a bit unfair on his parents and grandparents to say that, but not much money had been spent on it. And like a lot of estates get, you know, you're told not to sell anything. But at the end of the day, if you've got 400 cottages or 30 properties that are all derelict, if you sell one and do the rest up, you get more rent. And it's the old thing of, do you keep land or property? And at that stage, they owned most of the village. They chose to sell the farmland. And Thomas started to invest in converting some of the stables and outbuildings into shops and making Ripley a destination.
So if I can just explain, outside this fabulous 14th century castle, there is an amazing array of shops and tea rooms, and it feels so charming. You just feel as if when you drive here, you've arrived in the perfect Yorkshire village,
yeah.
Don't you? So I'm just imagining him, that young bride, that young you, arriving here at the tender age of 24. What was your role then?
Well, when I married Thomas, I was actually PA to a finance director. And I kept that job for 6 months. And then it became apparent that I was getting up early, making scones for the tea rooms, then going to work, coming back. And I think the way I look at it, and I'm sure you do the same, is although we're custodians of these for the next generation, it's still yours and my home. And I wouldn't have people in my home if it's not clean and there's not nice flowers and the food's not nice. So we saw it all along as being our home as well as our business. We went on to have 5 children. We wanted a family home for them, but it's got to earn its keep. So when the conference centre in Harrogate opened, we decided to host some dinners. And we treated them as if they were coming to dinner with us. So we would lay the tables, and I originally started doing the cooking. So I would cook. And when I got to cooking for about 50 people, I kind of used to times up my dinner party recipe. You know, the famous Delia Smith chocolate mousse recipe. I just used to think, well, if I'm making that for 100, I just times it up. And so I suddenly ended up kind of in big style catering. We then actually got to cook because it was getting ridiculous. But all along, we've tried to develop a quality product. I don't want people to come to Ripley and be ripped off, you know, go away and think, well, I paid £5 for that.
But can I just say, in the middle of all this, Emma, where were the children, the 5 children? Because you were a mum as well.
I'm a mum as well. So, yes, I'm a mum of 4 boys and a girl. I don't know how I juggled it, but we then did get really good. I've had 3 really good nannies over the years. And we'd be lying if we said we brought up our children and ran these places and had a career without help, because you have to acknowledge the help that
absolutely
covers it.
When you see that 700 years of the same line of Inglebys and you marry, I wouldn't imagine that 24-year-old girl that fell in love with that wonderful, handsome Sir Thomas ever thought that at the time.
Interestingly, Thomas was the last male Ingleby. There were no more after 750 years, absolutely no more direct Inglebys. He had 2 sisters, one of whom has no children and one has a girl.
Goodness.
So it would have all died out. So
did you feel a pressure to have a boy?
I did a tiny bit. I was quite relieved. I didn't realise I did till I had Jamie. And then Jamie was followed by Joss. And people used to jokingly refer to them as heir and spare. And then I had a girl who I adore, Eleanor Jane, named after Trooper Jane. And then 2 more boys, Jack and Richard. So actually, there's now plenty of Inglebys. Thank you very much. My job's done.
Tell me about whether or not moving into this wonderful home, this little slice of history in the middle of Yorkshire, you've ever come across obstacles when you arrived and through your journey here.
I haven't really experienced it. I think, you know, my mother-in-law, who had been, you know, in charge for a while because she was a trustee, she was, to be fair, very respectful about the fact we made changes. She didn't ever really comment.
Tell me about the blood of your family. Is your mother still alive?
My mum is 97 and worryingly sharp as tacks and still alive. And she married my father, met him in Hong Kong post-war. My father's family are actually Quakers from York. They were Quaker merchants.
Quakers? I'm a Quaker as well.
Well, I think the thing about Quakers is we care about people. We'll never be the hardest business people because we do care about our staff and we care about our business and we care about our customers.
And I also feel the other great Quakerism quality within us is that nothing is about money. It's about being custodians,
yeah.
It's about looking
great
after things.
Great sense of responsibility.
And it's about giving back.
Yeah. I mean, you and I would love to make money and we aim to try and make money, but we've still got a great sense of doing it the right way.
So one of the things was we've had a really very, very brief little trip around and I've been lucky enough to have Lady Ingleby show me some of the special things in her home. Tell me about the priest's hole and what is important in a Catholic home about having a priest's hole?
Well, exactly, because it was illegal to hold Catholic services. So you had to literally hide for your life. Now, we believe there were two here and it's literally a hole. They had to climb in. They could have to sit in there for days, weeks even, if the house was occupied. And you just had an air hole and a little shelf for your candle and a little bit of bread. And to find them, the soldiers could go between the panelling with their swords. So, you know, it was death if you were found.
Unbelievable.
And we actually believe that another Sir William Ingleby hid up there just after the Battle of Marston Moor.
Goodness. And there's one other thing that I was interested. Has Cromwell been here?
Yes. So after Marston Moor, Oliver Cromwell marched here. It's only about 12 miles away. It was the most bloody battle. It, you know, literally the River Ouse ran red. Sir William Ingleby and we believe his sister, Jane Ingleby, who was quite a feisty lady, both were at the battle. They managed to beat Cromwell back to the castle. Jane stayed downstairs, got on her dress. Sir William, we believe, legged it up the tower and hid in the priest's hole. Cromwell marched in. He shot prisoners against the church wall. So you can see against the church wall holes where he shot prisoners. He shot them against the castle gatehouse and you can see holes where he shot the prisoners because they'd have musket balls, big musket balls. And Jane would not let him search the house. She held him with two pistols all night in the library.
Oh, you're joking.
No, she was not going to let him pass because they'd have been put to death. And so they got away scot-free.
Amazing. Do you see that being a recurring thing here at Ripley Castle, the role of the women? Because she sounds to me as if she's been incredibly important at that time at holding the mantle up.
There are pivotal moments when it could have gone either way. And sometimes it is a woman who steps in. You know, we talked about Jane Ingleby. Going right back, the first Thomas Ingleby married an heiress called Edeline Thweng. And that enabled him to build the first manor house. There's sometimes a marriage and it's goods, but sometimes it's about their actions. And I think that you can't run places like this if you don't get involved. Like in the war, there were no staff. Everyone was fighting. Everyone was doing their bit. This became a Barnardo's home. You know, don't underestimate the woman who had to keep the home fires burning and keep the house going and keep everything together.
So I think what you're saying is that there's been no great heroes that we, and I feel exactly the same where I live. It's all about the woman stepping up and doing what they do in their generation at their time.
Yes.
Whatever that may be.
Yeah, and different times offer different opportunities. At the end of the day, you and I are probably doing a lot more than we used to, and you and I did quite a lot before, because the COVID is the civil war, the plague of its day. It's something we never saw coming that has completely changed everyone's lives. You know, we had 7 months when we furloughed over 100 people and the garden still keeps growing. You know, jobs still needed doing. Actually, my home team was 3 men and 3 women.
Yes.
And don't underestimate how much we needed all those people. And we all, 6 of us, just did everything that needed doing on this estate for months.
We have some wonderful stories here at Ripley about rebellion. Something to do with gunpowder plot?
Yes. So Ripley hosted James IV of Scotland. It was 1603. So he stayed, but interestingly, 2 years later, the Ingleby's were plotting against him. And 9 out of 11 of the conspirators in the gunpowder plot were Ingleby's or related to the Ingleby's.
Oh, you're joking.
No, the gunpowder plot was a plot to blow up Parliament. James had come down from Scotland, had been king for barely 2 years, was making what they call a hash of it. And because the king wasn't elected, the only way to get rid of the king, who was Parliament, was to blow him up. So they smuggled gunpowder underneath the Houses of Parliament. And Guy Fawkes, who was a St. Peter's schoolboy from York, was in charge of lighting the match. But sadly, they were betrayed and he was caught. They did very well to get away with it, I have to say.
With because, their heads on their shoulders.
Well, they were charged, but interestingly, the witnesses changed their minds and couldn't identify any of them.
So when we moved into Beaver Castle, one of the things that I was hit by were these things that go on in the night in the castle. And I didn't thankfully see anything, but the children did. We had ghosts stepping out of wardrobes. Violet had one horrible one in the corner of her room. Do you have any stories like that here, Emma?
We do. I think any really old building where, you know, people have lived and died does have ghosts. There is a rather sad story. So Alicia Ingleby, who had 2 children, both children died of meningitis, aged 4 and 9, and they died within 4 months of each other. Alicia, the guides have seen, she wafts around the house in a long dress. She actually died in the castle and I think pretty well went mad with grief. She was a broken woman. But the children are naughty. The children are definitely around and they hide stuff all the time. Keys disappear. I lost the key to a jewel box. Not that I've got any jewels, but I like to have a jewel box. And couldn't find it for 2 years. And I thought, I'm going to have to get this box broken into. Put my foot in a pair of shoes that I wear all the time. There was the key in the toes.
No.
A bit naughty.
Yeah, I had every hair on my body standing up just then. Do you speak to them?
I do. I tell them off. They've got a safe key at the moment and I'm quite cross. I'm like, put it back soon. They're just so naughty.
So naughty.
I have threatened to get the vicar in to have a word with them. But I kind of, their pictures are downstairs and you can see them. And it's rather sad. And I think I've got a grandchild at the moment. You see the toys in the hall and she comes for a day. And I think they're just
part of the family.
Part of the family.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you, do ever the portraits talk to you?
Do yours talk to you?
A little bit.
Do they?
They do. I've got this 5th Duchess who's with me all the time.
Is she?
She is.
Is she good news? Is she helpful?
Oh, yeah, no, she's with me. She's guiding me the whole time. I mean, sometimes do you ever feel that this house found you to do the job?
I feel nothing but warmth from this house.
Okay, so we're all a bit cranky, aren't we? Is that a feather or a wasp?
That's actually a wasp just flown over your head. Sorry, I looked as if I'd seen a ghost. Can I just say that's actually a wasp that's just gone to rest again.
Having a little sunny moment here in the yellow drawing room at Ripley Castle. Aside from the ghosts and wasps, what manages to constantly surprise me about Emma's home is how beautifully adorned it is. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast presented by me, Emma Rutland, and produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. The charming ornaments, the family portraits, the elegant style of the decoration is as much a testament to the previous tenants as it is to Emma, who, along with her openness and intelligence, has wonderful taste. I was eager to find out which pieces she loved the most. So, Emma, what are some of your favourite heirlooms and works of art in your home?
I like some of the quirky bits. So, for example, we have it's actually very interesting. It's for dispensing wine, and it's like it's on a swivel, and there's an expression, you must have heard the expression, pushing the boat out.
Yes.
Well, this is where it comes from. It's on wheels and you'd send it down the table and rather than touch the bottle, you would lift it and swivel it and pour it. And it's very old. We took it to Australia on a tour once and we had to point out that it is a little older than modern Australia. I also brought back from my family a William Morris cabinet, which is in the large drawing room of the castle. We have the original bill from William Morris. My family, the Birmingham side of the family, were all into arts and crafts. And William Morris made it specifically for my great-great, I think, grandfather. And I've inherited that, and that's downstairs. And so, do you know what? I quite like that a little bit of me is sitting in this castle, hopefully, for the next. It's sometimes it's about give and not just take.
On that, I remember the Duke saying to me when we got married, "What are you bringing into this marriage, Emma?" And I took with me a Welsh dresser and a rather plain Welsh table and six chairs back from the farm. So, yes, we all bring our little bit in,
yes,
don't we?
Yes. Make your mark. I hope you mentioned that you were going to have his children. And he said, "What are you bringing in?"
I did that too,
yes,
just like you.
Yes, you did that, just like me.
So Ripley Castle, where we are today, apparently has an extensive collection of tropical plants and rare vegetables.
We do have bananas, oranges. We do have a cacti collection. We have orchids. We have some really coffee plants we're planting at the moment. And we also have palm house. So we do have a collection. I have to say, I don't entirely know what I'm doing. And every time an orchid comes out, we all kind of cheer and put a picture on Facebook immediately.
But you've learnt that, Emma.
I've had to learn. I used to go and see the gardeners. We had 2.5 to 3 gardeners plus some volunteers. At the moment, I am the only gardener full time. We had to make the gardener redundant because we have no income from the gardens, as you know, until next March after COVID when we can all reopen.
How many acres of garden?
There's 6 in the walled garden, and then there's another 9 in the pleasure grounds. And then, of course, we've got all the plants in the village and the Boar's Head garden. And
all those pots in the village are done by your good
all
self?
All those pots in the village are done by my good self. It's a wing and a prayer, trust me.
It's superwoman to me.
Mm.
What is the secret of a great British garden?
I think you just do what makes you happy. I think a traditional English garden is very green and very relaxed. I'm not a great one for lines of flowers. Nature doesn't grow in straight lines. We plant in lines. And avenues of trees are marvellous, but anything else wants to be as nature intended it, you know, free-flowing. And as I said, I'm not a natural gardener. I kind of garden by... we need something, you know, pale there and something, you know, white there. And then we need a soft shrub there. So I come at it from a kind of architectural point of view. And also, can I pick it? But I think gardens, the secret of a great English garden is, does it make you happy? Does it lift your spirits, you know, when you come home?
Like anyone on any scale, your garden.
Absolutely. If you've only got a plot the size of this room, then quite frankly, can you sit in it? Does it make you happy?
Yeah.
And does it, you know, give you joy?
And where do you sit in your garden, Emma?
Well, interestingly, we're open to the public. So when we were shut originally during lockdown, Thomas and I put a table and chairs on the terrace. We sat having lunch on the terrace. He is 65 years old, and it is the first time in his life he has sat on his own terrace having lunch undisturbed, because it's the first time that there haven't been visitors in his lifetime.
Wow.
And, you know, that's kind of quite a sobering thought. Don't get me wrong, we love sharing our gardens, but actually just to be able to walk around your own gardens and not bump into anyone has been a bit of a joy.
Well, and a first.
And a first. A first for both of us.
And that's making you feel quite emotional.
It was at the time. I mean, we're open again now. And I have to say, I love visitors going around, and I love people, I don't love people asking me questions. The problem is, when I'm kind of bottom up and head down, digging in a herbaceous border, they mistake me for a gardener. So they come up and they keep asking me questions. And I go, well, you know, I said, I'm afraid I'm only a volunteer. You're going to have to ask one of the gardeners when they come back. So they ask me questions like, what is that? And what do you do with your dahlias? I'm like, well, I Google it, but I can't tell you that.
Oh, that's wonderful, then. Do you feel that as Lady Emma Ingleby living in Ripley, that the people that surround you are intrepidy of you? Do you feel that you hold the mantle of the community by the people you employ here? What do you feel your role is within this very local community here in Yorkshire?
I suppose I don't seek opinion, but I think that people are respectful of someone they can see as trying very hard and trying their best. And Thomas and I have made decisions, for example, that are not short-term commercial decisions, but based on what's best for the village. It would be easy to fill this village with cheap tat shops, you know, gift shops and things. And we've chosen to try and retain the character of this village. And any commercial leases we've given, we've tried to have a balance. So there's an art gallery, a small clothes shop, a gin tasting room, a village shop. There was a little florist shop. We're the long-term custodians of Ripley. It's in our interest to make Ripley Castle and Village still charming and a nice place to be.
It's a lovely thing to be able to do, isn't it? To support local crafts and local industries and to make it totally bespoke to you. Mm. What you've done as I came through Ripley today, there's nothing that's the high street. And maybe that's going to be perfect as we move forward away from these large shopping centres. You've created this unique experience coming to Ripley.
Well, you've done more at Beaver, haven't you?
Yes, but it's been wonderful to do it and to be able to support local crafts. We have got this little retail village that we have now developed and turned round. I've got my own Duchess's Gallery. And one of the things that is terrifying about this current situation, of course, is that so many of them are now struggling because it's been so difficult. So we are giving rent-free periods and it's been really difficult because I don't know about you, but I've had to borrow quite a lot of money to get it to where it's come to. And I've got to pay the bank back.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because if you aren't in this world, you look at these big houses full of art and you kind of think, but it can't be touching them. But you and I need to earn income. It's, you know, if you kept selling all your art, we'd all end up with bare walls and the art would be gone. At the end of the day, you and I are custodians and our job is to try and keep it going without selling too much.
And do you feel that is recognised by government?
No, because the problem is, and it doesn't matter which government it is, you know, the fact is it just seems not a good cause because it seems so wealthy. And I think that, you know, there is a lot of wealth, but it's in assets, and it's assets that we are holding, you know, for the next generations, because Britain's heritage is worth millions, you know, as a tourism market. And it is what makes Britain. And it's technically, although you and I own it, we are giving access to people to try and share it. And I think that whichever party you're talking about, they don't want to be seen to be giving money to places like this because we're supposed to be able to earn it ourselves. But I can tell you for a fact that every month in lockdown, even though we shut the castle up and shut everything, we were 30,000 a month just in running costs, insuring it, you know, just doing nothing.
Standing still.
Well, you know, 6 months of lockdown, what's your bill? And that's before you've paid for the staff.
This is a really poisoned chalice because it can appear to the outside world as if we're being so spoilt. Mm. But you've got a roof here that you're going to pay for. There will be no money that is... there's no grant available because there's no money. And yet you have this immense passion to do it. Do you think we are, as families like ourselves, keeping the USP, which is our heritage together, private heritage together, do you think we're respected by officials in this country?
I think heritage generally, you know, you've got English Heritage and the National Trust. I think that private ownership is always a difficult question because I think you've got to persuade people that although it's privately owned, you are sharing it and looking after it. You know, we've always allowed full access. I think, you know, it's all about trying to understand that we can't afford to let these things just leave the country. I mean, you know, container loads of art going abroad to wherever it's going is not good for this country. The thing about private ownership, the thing about a family in single ownership is that there's continuity and the decisions are made on a different basis.
And they're made from a female point of view, so they're always a home.
Yeah. The first thing, you know, it's got to be is when you look around a privately owned stately home is that you should sense that it is a living, breathing. It's not been mothballed and they pick a moment in time. And although it's beautiful, it's mothballed. It's a living, breathing house. and home.
And of course, things always make one emotional, don't they, when we're doing this job, but whatever it may be, we have to have a sort of rod of iron within us. And I would say that one of the touching things is sitting here with you in your home and watching. How many years have you been married?
36.
Oh my goodness.
I know. It's frightening.
Unbelievable.
Honestly.
Well, I am actually officially still married, and the Duke and I are legally separated. But it, of course, always brings that little bit within one that we didn't just make that journey together, but we are the very best of friends. And luckily enough for me, he's put me in charge of carrying on the mantle of together we run the estate, and he's entrusted with me with the job.
You know, your marriage, in the way that it is now, your separation, it works for you, as you say. You know, the Duke very wisely decided that actually you do a brilliant job. The fact that you can't still be married is just one thing. You have, you know, beautiful children. You are running it, you know, in a different way. And I think it's like everything. If it works for you, and it does, and as you say, you're very lucky. You're very good friends with him. You're best friends with him. He supports you. You support him. There's a lot of marriages, Em, that doesn't happen,
it's
in,
so true.
Quite frankly. So I think, whatever it takes to get through. So actually, you know, you do a great job too. And,
well,
and
we
both know it's not
best.
Easy.
And being women in heritage, it sometimes takes you to the bottom of your
It's
core.
A very private club. It's the Stately Wives Club, certainly amongst the girls who are hands-on. You can't explain to someone who's not married to a stately home what it's like.
No.
And there's no rules, and there's, you know, you just need a mate that you can ring up, and you and I talk, you know, quite often, and we have an email correspondence out of the blue, and you go, what do you think about this, and what can I do about that? And I would always ask my girlfriends for advice and give it.
Because no one ever really quite gets it unless you're in that
no.
club. And I guess it's been like that for generations. So
absolutely, it's just a bit more public now.
And we get, don't we, that this job that we do is not about money. It isn't about taking money from it. It's about the service and what we can do to support it in the journey of its extended life.
Yeah. When they ask you to marry them, you know, the first decision is, do I love you and want to be with you? But the second decision, and you'd be stupid not to think about it, is, you know, am I going to be committed to this? And am I going to leave this in a better or the same as I found it? Because, you know, I get really sad when you see an ugly divorce and the wife destroys the property, you know, because she takes the money. And Thomas, his mother wanted him to sign a prenup, me to sign a prenup. And Thomas said, no, I trust her. And I didn't sign a prenup. But I know plenty of people who are now asking their children's wives to sign prenups. We wouldn't do it. Jamie wouldn't sign one, wouldn't ask his wife to sign one, because I trust that she gets that this is Jamie's and must be preserved at all costs.
It's a very interesting discussion, and one that you only really understand when you come into it, because you learn to respect everything around you and recognize that you are doing your bit, but I brought a Welsh dresser, you brought your wonderful
Morris cabinet,
but we're just passing through.
When you look back, we're just a blip, really, you know, we're just a blip. Hopefully a good blip. And in the guidebook, we'll get a good section.
Exactly. So let me ask you, do you see it being a visitor attraction into the future, six generations down the line?
I would like to think that these houses still exist. I would like to think that people are still wanting to come and see them. You know, they are part of the nation's heritage. They may belong to us, but they are.
What would you say to six generations past, to the lady of the house?
I think I'd say, I hope that I've looked after it for you, and I hope you don't kind of think, what have you done? It's kind of almost more interesting to look forward and say, you know, will there be six generations forward? And what would you leave as a note for them?
Okay, well, that's the next question.
Is it? God, it's like
so
a psychic.
Six generations forward, what would your gentle words of guidance be to your great, 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 great granddaughter?
Follow your heart, follow your instincts, and be kind, really, and just try your best. I mean, I think you have to say, do it because you love it or you get joy from it. And if you don't, then step aside and put a manager in who is going to love it.
Well, Emma, can I say, Ripley Castle, is going to be here for those generations, with you behind them floating around as yet another little lady who was once upon a time. You won't let it ever go. So well done, you. Can you tell the visitor and our listeners, what would they expect when they arrive at Ripley, and how do they find out about what happens here?
Okay, first thing I need to say, because it sometimes goes wrong, is there's three Ripleys in this country, so definitely set your sat-nav to Ripley, Yorkshire, because there's one in Derbyshire and one in Surrey. You're joking, but half the guests from my eldest son's wedding went to Ripley, Derbyshire, and wondered why the church was empty. We are online at www.ripleycastle.co.uk. To be honest, you just Google Ripley Castle. To be honest, even if the castle's shut, come and visit the village. There's shops, there's cafes, there's a pub, a hotel.
Your hotel is...
at the Boar's Head. So you can stay at the Boar's Head. You could stay in Harrogate. It's the most wonderful area to be based in anyway. Please come and visit. Get married here. Have a dinner here. Just stroll around the gardens. Please don't talk to the gardener because she doesn't know what she's doing. And come and visit us.
Thank you, Emma. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. You're quite an extraordinary lady. For some reason, I've always felt as if you're a mother-like figure with your arm around us all. And definitely my Lady of the North.
Oh, thank you. I wish I could hug you.
Oh, I want to have a cry now.
Beautiful.
Beautiful moment there. I do mean it.
Well, my Lady of the North was an absolute pleasure to meet today. Ripley has always been a place defined by bravery and independent thinking. Emma absolutely fits that mould, and with people like her to help guide all of us running these homes, especially Ripley Castle, are secure for generations to come. Thank you, Emma, for joining us today. You're always such a warm, compassionate woman to share a conversation with. Next week on Duchess, I invite you all to join me as I travel to one of the globe's most iconic structures, Blenheim Palace, to meet the brilliant Lady Henrietta Spencer Churchill. Henrietta talks about her childhood in Blenheim, and we hear the extraordinary story of the palace's construction. She also elaborates on her royal invitation. Quick notes before we go. Important ones. Make sure you subscribe to Duchess the podcast so you get automatically notified about new episodes wherever you listen to a podcast. I want to know about you and what you think of the show, so please be sure to send me your comments and tell me about your own lineage and the women who have inspired you in your life. Please write to me on duchess@duchessthepodcast.com. And if there are any stately homes in particular you'd like me to visit, do send your suggestions to me as soon as possible. I've started a newsletter that includes all this and more and comes straight to your inbox. It's really easy to sign up at duchessthepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast, presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Lady Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofies and Theo Banner. Thanks for listening to Duchess, the podcast.